That was the Ramones. We want the airwaves. And hello, I'm your host, David Johnson. Welcome to the March 21st, 2009 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you on the air by WFT 90.1 FM Champaign and webcast worldwide at www.weft.org. Here today with co-host Tom Thomas, who has some news in the Labor Hour Culture Corner for us. Tom's poem this week is entitled To the Off-Ramps. Also here with us today is co-host Bob Pelesny, our technical expert and financial advisor, who will also have some news and banner for us. And the views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WFT, its board of directors, associates, station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated. And this is the Illinois World Labor Hour. And today we're going to be having some really interesting news stories. Lots been going on all over the world. And also we're going to be having a special guest call in at 11:30. His name's Steve Early. And he's originally a rank and file Communication Workers of America member. And he's recently written a book, Embedded with Organized Labor, Journalistic Reflections on the Class War at Home. And he also recently wrote an article that was entitled Why We Don't Need a Labor House of Lords. So anyway, stay tuned, and you'll be listening to some really interesting information today. Tom?
The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the Illinois Education Association Teachers Union and the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice. Building coalitions amongst workers, unions, and the community, the Illinois Education Association and the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice are proud to support WEFT Community Radio in East Central Illinois. This hour of programming is also brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of Maintenance Way. The Brotherhood of Maintenance Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour, a democratic union. BMWE celebrates the voice of labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, and early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And finally, the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interest of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. Dave?
Okay, great. We have some news stories today. Bob, would you like to start out? You threw a figure at me earlier today, right before the show. Do you want to repeat that for our listeners? Because it really shocked me as far as this financial crisis.
We were talking about how much people say Obama has been spending on the bailout here. And I came across some figures a while back that said that through December, while President Bush was still in office, we had spent $7.9 trillion on the financial bailout. And up through about the beginning of March, we had spent a total of $11.2 trillion.
But, so it's $11.2 trillion that's been handed over to the banks so far?
Yes. Yes. And three-quarters of that or more, you know, $8 trillion basically during Bush's administration.
I think it's interesting how there's just been the same policies continuing, both with the financial crisis and the wars, the wars of empire between the Bush administration and the Obama administration. I mean, I thought we had an election in this country. Where's our democracy?
Nothing much has changed, has it?
No, not in that regard. Absolutely not. Okay, Bob, what do you have for as far as the news story today?
Well, I came across an interesting story. We've been talking about the healthcare workers and the unions out in California, and I came across an interesting story here. Two long-feuding healthcare unions said this week that they have put aside their differences in a collaborative effort to lobby for labor-friendly legislation and to aggressively promote union membership in the healthcare sector. The California Nurses Association, CNA, based in Oakland and representing 85,000 registered nurses, and the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, representing 2 million service workers, including nurses and other healthcare workers, both said they have agreed to refrain from raiding the other's ranks and together try to achieve common goals. These include lobbying for congressional passage of the Employee Free Choice Act, legislation backed by labor and dreaded by many employers. It would give labor help in organizing because unions could represent workers if a majority approved. Currently, workers seeking union representation must vote in a secret ballot election overseen by the National Labor Relations Board. Another priority is trying to organize more registered nurses and other healthcare workers with the initial focus on the nation's largest hospital chains. Only a month ago, the two unions were still casting stones. DeMauro, who's an executive director of the CNA, was a vociferous critic of Stern, saying he was far too cozy with major employers. Stern has acknowledged differences the SEIU has had with the Nurses Association, but said it is time to move on. At the lowest point in the relationship of the two unions, the Nurses Association last year tried to persuade 8,000 hospital workers in Ohio not to align with the SEIU. A few weeks later, SEIU members crashed a California Nurses Association meeting in Detroit. Later in April, the Nurses Association denounced the SEIU contingent as thugs and persuaded an Alameda County Superior Court Commissioner, John Rantzman, to issue a temporary restraining order barring Stern and members of his union from assaulting, stalking, or coming near the other union's organizers. Rantzman, within a few days, concluded he had issued the order improperly because the SEIU hadn't been given a chance to respond, and he lifted that. But interesting that these unions have been feuding for years.
Well, that's the thing is the California Nurses Association, which is a very militant and democratic union. I mean, it's only obvious that they have differences with SEIU, which is a very corporate, autocratic, undemocratic union that's very cozy with management and corporations in general. And that's only logical they've had differences. But it is really interesting that they've actually joined common, at least for the time, being allies on this Employee Free Choice Act.
There is still the other union out there, the United Healthcare Workers West, that has been trying to they're trying to get themselves out of the SEIU and form their own union.
Yeah, decertify is what it is.
Decertify,
yeah.
You got it.
Yeah. Okay, Tom, and you have some couple interesting stories for us today.
Yeah, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is edging closer to the possible regulation of emissions of heat-trapping gases from coal-fired power plants. Lisa Jackson, the new administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, accepted a petition last month by the Sierra Club to reconsider a controversial memorandum related to coal plant emissions that was issued in December by her predecessor, Stephen L. Johnson. Johnson's memorandum, which so far remains in effect, prevents the federal approval process for power plants from taking into consideration the quantity of emissions of carbon dioxide into our atmosphere. Although the EPA has so far declined to suspend the memorandum, many environmentalists are embracing the acceptance of the petition by Ms. Jackson as another upward step in their efforts to stop further construction of coal-fired power plants and initiate some 21st century green technology to combat global warming. Auto industry analysts are suggesting that spending some government auto aid money for direct-to-consumer incentives could boost sales and greatly benefit the entire industry. They say the government could provide discount vouchers for new car buyers, as is presently and successfully being done in Europe. Or the government could underwrite the cost of a federal version of South Korean automaker Hyundai's successful assurance plan. Under the Hyundai assurance plan, you can return the car if you lose your income because you're laid off or for other specified reasons. Hyundai will cancel your loan even if you owe more than the car is worth and won't put a black mark on your credit file. Another plan, usually called scrappage, provides government discounts for new car buyers if they trade in old cars to be scrapped. That is currently being done in several European nations, and its value is seen as not only improving car sales, helping out automakers, dealers, parts suppliers, and lenders, but also retiring the older vehicles that pollute more, use more fuel, and are much less safe. And a long-awaited rally finally arrived at the end of February on Wall Street, delivering a much-needed financial stimulus to profit-starved stock investors. A day after sinking to nearly 13-year lows, the stock market rebounded more than 6%, its biggest bounce since November. as investors reacted to glimmers of hope in the beleaguered banking sector. Driving the broad rally was news that Citigroup, the battered banking giant, actually turned a profit in the first two months of the year. Investors viewed that as a possible sign that the hard-hit financial sector is finally stabilizing, a condition that is necessary for the stock market and the economy to begin a healing process. Adding to the bullish tone, which had been mostly absent most of the year, were hints from lawmakers in both houses of Congress that the government may soon bring back a trading rule that would make it harder for traders who profit when stocks fall to inflict major damage to individual stocks.
Yeah, we'll have to see about that. Okay, I got some news stories from abroad. Serge Fouchere looked the very picture of business management when his 24-hour imprisonment at the hands of angry workers ended yesterday morning. Happy to be free and see the light of day again, said Mr. Fouchere, the chief executive officer of Sony France. Mr. Fouchere's Sony head of human resources and two local plant officials were held in a meeting room in a videotape factory at Ponneau-sur-l'Adour in the Landes region of southwest France. The plant's 311 employees were notified in December that they would lose their jobs and the factory closes on April 17th. Mr. Fouchere dropped by to say a last farewell on Thursday afternoon and was detained by workers objecting to the severance pay package they'd been offered. They blocked access to the plant with branches and trees and trunks and 20 gendarmes surround the site. Patrick Hauschiger, the local representative of the CGT trade union, said the atmosphere inside the plant was good-natured, though the Sony executives may have thought differently. He won't listen to us. We had no other solution, Mr. Hauschiger added. The latest incident of boss snapping ended at 10:30 a.m. when the Sony executives walked out of the plant accompanied by trade union representatives. When Sony faced factory closed a year ago in Alsace, financial benefits were 50% better for severance pay, the workers said. And this was basically what sparked this incident of boss snapping. I'd like to thank David Powers for providing that article. More news here. Martinique, 38-day general strike in the Caribbean colony of Martinique ended March 14th with the signing of a protocol between the government and the February 5th Collective, a coalition of unions and other social movements named after the day the strike began. The agreement grants the coalition's key demands. About 20,000 people celebrated the historic victory in a march through the streets. AFP reported that the signing ceremony drew a crowd of thousands who gathered outside the island's head administrative office. They repeatedly chanted a slogan, Martinique Leve, or Martinique Stand Up, in the local Creole language. A draft agreement reached early in the morning of March 11th calls for a $250 monthly wage increase for 47,000 low-wage earners, with smaller increases for those with higher incomes. Workers will get retroactive pay to March 1st. Major business owners had already agreed to lower prices on roughly 400 basic necessities by 20% one month after stores reopen. And there are other terms similar to the agreement that ended a 44-day general strike in the neighboring island of Guadeloupe on March 4th. Paris and France in general. General strike was called this week by the French labor union leaders and students as well. They won widespread public sympathy with opinion polls showing 74% support for Thursday's day of action, with threats to become a serious political crisis for the government of President Nicolas Sarkozy. The public mood never in great sympathy with Sarkozy's so-called reform plans to privatize the economy and labor market has been badly affected by rising unemployment in instances like the announcement of hundreds of job losses by the total oil and gas giant, despite a record profit of more than $20 billion. Even the government's labor minister called this scandalous. It is always dangerous for a French government to fight on two fronts, against the students and against the labor unions at the same time. But that is the position Sarkozy now faces, and he does so with very little public support behind him. Last week, 60,000 students and academics took the street to protest Sarkozy's so-called policies of reform, which are fairly modest by U.S. or British standards. Oh, you got to love those French. I mean, they'll go out and strike at the drop of a hat. And you know what? As a result of that, they've got a lot more than we do as far as they got 5 weeks vacation, 100% health care, free education all the way through the university level, better work rules, stronger unions, and what's the matter with us? Why don't we get out in the streets? I mean, my God, we got the worst standards here of any industrialized country in the world. But anyway, a little closer to home, a group of disgruntled workers at a recently closed auto parts supply store in Windsor, Ontario, and have taken over the plant. And the latest bizarre twist in a saga that has been brewing since two auto plants in the area shut down early last week. About a dozen workers occupied the Aradco plant Tuesday night. They welded the door shut from inside and say they will not leave until they get what they are owed. Work at the Aradco plant stopped last week because of a dispute between the plant owners and Chrysler, which has mused publicly about pulling out of its Canadian operations unless unionized workers make substantial concessions. And a little update on that story, I just saw this morning that I guess the workers got all their demands that they wanted as far as severance pay and other items. And I forgot to mention in that story, I just read about the French general strike. I've got an update from our Labor Hour correspondent Walter Held in Europe. This came from Walter. Up to 3 million French workers demonstrated in the streets Friday in another powerful general strike against the Sarkozy government. In Paris alone, it is reported that 350,000 took part in the march. 300,000 in Marseille, according to the CGT Union Federation, marched as well. Marches took place in a large number of other cities and towns across the country. Strikes took place on the railways, Air France, public utilities, schools, TV, radio, and the banks and auto industries. Slogans included, "You are the crisis, we are the solution. Work more to pay more, defend purchasing power." Up to 80% of the population in France, according to recent polls, support the aims of the demonstrators. And he also added that the French trade unions will be meeting on March 30th to decide how to prepare for the next stage in the struggle, which is scheduled to happen on May Day, which, of course, is International Workers' Solidarity Day. But, yeah, things are getting really interesting around the world here, especially in Europe. Bob, did you have some other stories?
Well, I had one I thought was kind of interesting here, Dave. A U.S. firm is going to close their branch due to a lack of employees. A Florida-based firm will soon close one of its North Dakota offices for a reason that seems unfathomable during the deepening U.S. recession. It can't find enough employees to hire. Sykes Enterprises, which is creates and maintains computer customer care services for corporations, opened a telephone call center in Minot, North Dakota in 1996. Last May, management wanted to increase the number of employees to 450. Yet an unexpected thing happened. So few people applied for the Minot jobs that the Tampa-headquartered company will have to close the call center on May 10th, a cutback by Sykes that will result in 200 people losing their jobs. A Sykes spokeswoman, Andrea Burnett, said, "We've been working for several months there in Minot to find enough applicants for the work since they've been experiencing significant growth in the U.S. But apparently they're going to go ahead and close down that branch there because they can't find people to take the jobs.
Oh, interesting. Okay, we'll be right back. Tom Thomas's poem today, "To the Off-Ramps."
standing there beside the off-ramp, shoulders hunched against the cold wind, holding up a hand-printed sign, "I need to work, my life to mend." A livelihood taken away brought that worker out that cold day. There are off-ramps by the thousands across our poor and hungry land. On the majority of them, you'll likely see a worker stand. And they may be man or woman, but each one's a needful human. Once they may have had a good job that paid their bills and fed their kids, until some thieving banker schemes drove many out into the skids. So many had to leave a home into the busy off-ramps roam. A stimulus was promised us, but instead the layoffs increase, and all that help is nowhere seen, as so many dreams have to cease. Children under overpasses don't sleep well on prickly grasses. They who claim it's not depression that our nation's wallowing in need to lose their power and gold and show some penance for their sin. To the off-ramps they need to go, and poverty they need to know. To the Off-Ramps was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois on March 11, 2009, and was first recited live March 21, 2009 on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Thank you, Tom. And we have some public service announcements. A planning meeting for the May 1st and May 2nd People's Potluck Central Illinois Social Forum will be at 2 p.m. today in the family room at the IMC. All are welcome to, with input on planning this monumental event coming up here on May Day weekend. That's today at 2 p.m. the family room at the IMC. New Labor television program has just arrived in CU. Labor's View. Tune in this Sunday and every Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m. on UPTV Channel 6 and see, as well as hear, Labor's View. And Friday, May 1st, is National Call-In Sick Day. Reclaim Labor's holiday and show our strength to the bankers and other thugs. Okay, we are now going to, we're going to be getting a call pretty soon from Steve Early, but in the meantime, I'm going to leave you with a little inspirational music from the Black Eyed Peas.
We need an antidote and a cure. Cause do you really think Muhammad got a problem with your whole world? We don't know. Imagine if every prophet was alive in current days amongst you and I. If you think they would view life like you and I do, or would they sit and contemplate on why do we live this way, act and behave this way? We still living primitive today, cause the peace of the destination in war can't be the way. There's no way. So people just be a woman, be a man. Realize that you can't change the world by changing yourself, and understand that we all just the same. So when I count to three, let's change. Let's start a union, calling every human. It's one for all and all for one. Let's live in unison, calling every city sun. It's one for all and all for one. No time for grand philosophy. I'll barely keep my head above the tide. I got this mortgage, got three kids in school. What you're saying is the truth, but really troubles me inside. I'd change the world if I could change my mind. If I could live beyond my fears. Exchanging unity for all my insecurity. Exchanging laughter for my tears. Whoa, 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 whoa. Let's start a union, calling every human. It's one for all and all for one. Whoa, son. Calling every city, son. It's one for all and all for one. In the real deposition, in the midst of all this negative condition, divided by beliefs, differences in religion. Why do we keep missing the point on our mission? Why are we killing each other? What's the reason? God made us all equal in his vision. I wish that I could make music as a religion. Then we could harmonize together in this mission. Listen, I know it's really hard to make changes, but two of us can help and rearrange this. Cause utilize our power and our voices. Together we will unite and make the right choice and fight for education. Save the next generation. Come together as I don't understand why it's never been done. So let's change on a count of one. It takes one, just one. And then one falls the other one. And then the other falls another one. Next thing you know you got a billion. People doing some wonderful things. People doing some powerful things. Let's change and do some powerful things. Unity could be a wonderful thing.
Okay, I think that's our guest today. Hello, WFT.
This is Steve Early in Boston.
Yes, Steve.
Dave Show.
Yes, welcome to the show. You're on the air. How you doing today?
Good.
Okay, well, I'm glad you called. You were very punctual there, and we just sent a song called Union by the Black Eyed Peas, so, I mean, your timing was just impeccable. Okay, Steve, why don't you start out by telling us a little about yourself. You were a rank-and-file member of the Communication Workers originally?
Yes. I finished up 2 years ago, a 27-year stint as an organizer and international rep for CWA, based here in Boston, but working in the union's largest district, which covers New York, New Jersey, and New England.
Uh-huh.
And I was involved in both the public sector and private sector organizing and bargaining, primarily in the telephone industry. Our big adversary here is Verizon.
Okay, yes, Verizon. But, you know, of course, over the last couple of years, I've, you know, seen a lot of stories about Verizon, and not very worker-friendly employer, it appears.
Well, we've had some major struggles over the years, as you may know, about the company's resistance to unionization of its very large and fast-growing wireless subsidiary, Verizon Wireless, which is almost entirely non-union.
Mm-hmm.
The traditional phone company part of Verizon throughout the U.S. is heavily unionized with bargaining units composed of CWA members and also our brothers and sisters in the IBEW.
Okay. Well, you know, I want to talk about your book today, of course, Embedded with Organized Labor, A Journalistic Reflection on the Class War at Home. But first I wanted to talk a little bit about a recent article you wrote called Why Labor Doesn't Need a House of Lords. Do you want to I'll just start off with, I guess, the New York Times, March 9th, 2009, quote here. It said, also being debated at the AFL-CIO Executive Council meeting is whether to create a mechanism to nudge past their prime union presidents to retire so unions are not stuck with tired, uninspired leaders. One negotiator of AFL-CIO Change to Win, NEA Unity, talked of creating an advisory house, labor house of lords to encourage older union presidents to step aside. And that's kind of how you start, you know, you did that quote to start your article with. And do you want to talk a little about that article?
Sure. It was a satirical piece for a newsletter called Counterpunch. But it's really a serious and an important topic that I think it was unusual to see at least a few people in labor grappling with, if not the right way. You know, I'm sure as union members listening in know, one of our problems in the labor movement today is just how old we are. Three-quarters of all union members are over the age of 35. We are not relating well to younger workers anywhere in the country, I think. And, you know, at the top ranks of labor, we have a problem with top national union and AFL-CIO officials hanging on to their jobs well past what used to be normal retirement age of 65. We're telling people who are still claiming to be union leaders in their late 70s, even their early 80s. And I think this this geriatric culture, as I call it in the article, really does a disservice to the labor movement. I think we need new blood. We need younger people. We need to get some of these people out to pasture, and some new people coming up from the ranks who are more in touch with the problems of today's workplace emerging as new leaders in the labor movement if it's really going to revive and become a more revitalized institution.
Yeah, you know, I couldn't agree with you more about trying to get more, you know, younger people involved in leadership positions of labor, particularly from the rank and file. But I think the only, I guess there'd be a few exceptions to that as far as my own personal opinions. I mean, first of all, I'd sort of a common acquaintance friend of ours, 94-year-old Harry Kelburn, New York. I would love to see him president of the AFL-CIO. Heck, he'd probably do it for minimum wage and expenses. You know?
He may be running again in September.
Yes, but, you know, to me, it seems like it's, I mean, I'm not saying that that's not a problem, for sure, but to me, it seems like more of a problem of, one, that the top leadership are overpaid, two, they get too many perks, especially like how you point out in your article about this whole March spring break, if you will, AFL-CIO executive board trip to Bal Harbour, Florida, in a very expensive hotel, the Fountain Blue, and as you pointed out, if they eliminated that trip and some other little trip perks, they had to stay back in New York, especially in the wintertime, and had to actually deal with you know, labor issues and stuff, and representing us, that they might just be more inclined to retire earlier. Basically, your point is that it gives a disincentive with all these perks and six-figure salaries to retire early. So, I mean, I just had to throw that in there a little bit. I think there's more. It's more of also a disconnect too. I mean, there just doesn't seem like there's most unions, with some exceptions, the membership just doesn't have control, especially once you start getting beyond the state level.
I think that's true. I think there's a number of factors contributing to the problem of stodginess and lethargy at the top of labor, and age is one, though it's an important one.
Yes.
I think the overpaid officialdom is another problem. The perks at the top. I mean, when people get into their mid-70s, like John Sweeney, the national president of the AFL-CIO, he's not only collecting a $300,000 a year salary from the Labor Federation, he's collecting two or three pensions, Social Security. I mean, there's very little incentive for people to move on when they can be doing that well.
Yes.
I think clearly we need more democratic union structures to enable younger people, more rooted in the workplace, more in touch with the realities of local union life, to be able to move up into regional and national union positions. And that's why union democracy and reform movements, the sort that have developed in the service employees in the last year, of the sort that has operated in the Teamsters Union under the banner of Teamsters for a Democratic Union, movements like this are really important, because over time some of them have succeeded in opening up the internal processes of unions, changing from convention election of top officers to referendum votes where every member has a say. And making these institutions more democratic, which is the way they should be if they're really going to be responsive to their dues payers.
Indeed. Of course, there's also been some not-so-successful stories, like the union I'm a member of, the Carpenters Union. We had a revolt back in 98 through 2002, and basically, unfortunately, it failed. I mean, we had a four-year court battle. We were organized in the local level, national level, and it was just, you know, we learned a lot of lessons through that struggle, and one of them, I think, is, and this has been kind of reflected in the recent battle between United Healthcare Workers West and SEIU, is that under U.S. labor law, unlike other countries, the only option for members, really, if the international or the local, more likely the international union doesn't change and puts all sorts of impediments in your way, that the only option is to decertify. And, you know, it's interesting, in our struggle in the Carpenters, the only successful section of our rebellion was in British Columbia, Canada, and that was because of Canadian labor laws actually giving more weight to the will of the rank and file, where here it's almost a feudalistic system.
I think that's an excellent point. I mean, the unions can't have it both ways. I mean, they can't create these undemocratic structures, these huge mega-locals, multi-state locals with 80 to 100,000, 150,000, 200,000 members that really aren't susceptible to rank-and-file control, and then at the same time say that satisfied members can't leave and form or join alternative unions. And I think more of that's happening because as the process of change is blocked internally by undemocratic practices, people are embracing the idea that we should have unionized employee free choice. Same time, we're lobbying in Washington for employee free choice of a union initially. And employee free choice should embrace the idea that if you're dissatisfied with an incumbent union, you should be able to get a vote to switch to a better one. And as you pointed out, this is much more common in Canada. Mm-hmm. My experience working as a CWA rep a number of years ago in Quebec is that the competition that I noticed in Quebec among unions and two or three different labor federations really kept unions on their toes. It made them more responsive to members. It you know, phone calls got returned, grievances got handled better, contracts were negotiated in more aggressive fashion because incumbent unions knew that workers had a viable option of switching unions. And clearly, to decertify in the sense of going non-union is not a step forward.
No, absolutely not.
A danger here when there's employer intervention and encouragement of deunionization. But I think we really are seeing more, as you pointed out, particularly in California now with the new healthcare workers union, workers exercising their right to join rival unions. And I think it's healthy.
Yes, but it's very, very difficult. I mean, because first of all, you have to. There's only a certain window of opportunity you can do it, and I think it's what 3 months before your current contract expires. The other thing is, of course, there's always the the whisper campaign, basically spreading rumors by the officialdom that you know, the people that are initiating this are want to go non-union, or that by doing so will create, you know, dangers and this, that, and the other. So I mean, it's very difficult. I know from experience, after we had a four-year court battle, I want to point out, too, is you're not just facing internal union roadblocks when people try to make changes for the better in an unresponsive union in the United States. You're also facing corporate attorneys hired by the international. You're facing bought-off judges. You're facing bought-off politicians. And the real twist of this, the real irony, is it's all done with the members' money, you know. So and then on top of that, you've got employer workplace issues. So really, you're fighting on two fronts, you know, the rank and file, you know. So
it's a tremendous burden for rank and file activists to have to wage, as you say, this two-front war, fending off constant employer assaults in many industries and many unions, and dealing with the problem of the union itself not being very effective as a vehicle for mounting a successful defense of contracts and workplace rights. But I think, you know, people have risen to the occasion. They're doing it out in California mm-hmm. right now, where mm-hmm. Nearly 100,000 workers are awaiting a vote out there on whether they should remain members of the service employees in the healthcare industry or join what I consider to be a very exciting new union, the National Union of Healthcare Workers, which mm-hmm. was created when SEIU's third largest affiliate, which you mentioned, United Healthcare Workers West, was put under trusteeship by the International Union President Andy Stern in January. And mm-hmm. the workers said, you can't take our union away from us. We are the union.
Yes.
And
they begged to differ, though.
What's that?
They begged to differ. They said, no, it's not your union. It's our union.
Yes, I mean, that's exactly. And the International, disgracefully, mm-hmm. has intervened mm-hmm. in these cases. It's fighting the representation petitions that have been filed, over 350 of them. Really keeping the labor board busy out in California, and is scared stiff of putting this question of representation to a vote. And I think this really undermines, quite frankly, the overall very important campaign for passage of the Employee Free Choice Act, because as I mentioned earlier, I don't think you can be for, with any credibility, be for employee free choice and greater protection of that in organizing, which is necessary, and at the same time deny your own members the choice of joining another union if they're dissatisfied with their incumbent one.
I absolutely agree on that, of course. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the Employee Free Choice Act. Kind of a two-part question here is, one, isn't the Employee Free Choice Act is sort of a modification of the Taft-Hartley Act and kind of a reinsertion of more elements of the Wagner Act. Wouldn't it be more efficient to try to get rid of the Taft-Hartley Act? The second part of the question is, will the Employee Free Choice Act be enough? And if for some reason it doesn't pass, does the labor officialdom have a plan B?
Well, I think the second question is a very good one and a relevant one, because I think the campaign faces enormous obstacles. We know that the Democrats in Congress are always a disappointment waiting to happen, and notwithstanding the new president's recent expressions of support for labor law reform, clearly it's still going to be an uphill fight to get 60 votes at least in the Senate to avoid the Employee Free Choice Act legislation being killed through a filibuster, as it was, or a similar legislation was 30 years ago, when it was the last major attempt to reform the National Labor Relations Act under the Carter administration. The key, and as everyone knows, most controversial element of the Employee Free Choice Act is requiring employers to recognize new unions based on majority of workers signing union authorization cards rather than through the secret ballot election process of NLRB representation votes. You mentioned the Wagner Act. When it was originally passed in 1935, most of the initial mass organizing involving industrial unions in the late 30s and early 40s basically was card check organizing. I mean, workers in auto and steel and other basic industries by the thousands signed union cards, and then very often they struck for recognition when the employer refused to recognize the auto workers and the steel workers or any other union based on that expression of majority support. And really, in the early years of the Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Board only held elections when there were competing unions, and then both unions or all three unions would be on the ballot, and workers would have a vote to choose that way. You know, what happened in the late 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s is that things shifted primarily to the representation election method of unionization, and that deck is really stacked in favor of the employers. And in my experience, working in organizing in the telephone industry, certainly in New England, where we've had some privately negotiated card check deals with employer neutrality, it has definitely made it easier for workers to organize at companies like AT&T and AT&T Wireless without fear of being fired and harassed and discriminated against and all the problems that often happen in private sector organizing because of employer misconduct. I think it would be an even harder push at this point to repeal the Taft-Hartley Act, as helpful as that would be. And I think the Campaign for the Employee Free Choice Act, well, the legislation is not ideal, has generated a considerable amount of grassroots activity around the country.
Yes, indeed. Yes, I've seen it here locally.
And, you know, we're going to need more of that in the final phase of it here, because the employer counter campaign is monumental.
Oh, yes.
Very well funded, and major employers, as we've seen, are propagandizing their own employees, Walmart, other companies, to come out against something that's actually in the interests of non-union workers.
Okay, so in case this doesn't pass, I mean, what do you think labor's plan B should be?
Well, I think there are some models of union campaigns where, without the benefit of a law requiring employer recognition based on card check, unions have been able to win what they call free and fair elections, elections where there's less employer interference and intimidation. One recent victory was the United Food and Commercial Workers, which spent many years battling with Smithfield.
Oh, yes.
A big pork processing plant in Tar Heel, North Carolina. And as a result of years of community labor agitation, boycott activity, protests, demonstrations, interventions at shareholder meetings, Smithfield, late last year, finally agreed with the union to hold an election under better rules than existed in the past when workers had tried to organize there and been defeated. And by a narrow margin, the workers in that plant, 5,000 of them, voted to join the UFCW in North Carolina last December.
So, yeah, that's quite a victory in of itself, just
it
happening
is,
in North Carolina.
But I think, you know, and that wasn't the result of any top-down kind of deal about sweetheart first contract. That was a product of struggle, and I mm-hmm. think we need more campaigns like that where union resources are put to good use rather than wasted, and workers are supported on the shop floor. There was a very strong implant committee that was maintained in that plant. A lot of unity built over the years between immigrant workers in the plant and African Americans, and it wasn't just a kind of corporate campaign conducted from the outside. Workers staged several wildcat strikes over the years and were very much leaders in their own campaign. And I think that showed in the results when a vote was finally held. At one point, as we know, there was a RICO suit, a racketeering lawsuit, filed against the union and its supporters around the country as part of the company's fight against this campaign for a fair election. And actually, it was a settlement of that suit that produced the election ground rules that gave the union access to the workers and enabled the workers, for the first time, to organize and to vote to unionize without fear of harassment, intimidation, and firing, and so forth.
That RICO suit was outrageous. I mean, from what I remember correctly, it was based on the fact that the the union and its supporters, like Jobs with Justice, were slandering the company, if I'm not mistaken.
Exactly. And, mm-hmm. and you know, several of my brothers and sisters here, very involved in Jobs with Justice in Massachusetts, were named as individual plaintiffs. I mean, we're facing potentially, if the case went to went to trial and had been lost by the good guys, by the defendants, they were going to be personally liable for damages, you know, running to tens of thousands of dollars for their union activism. So, you know, RICO is definitely a double-edged sword, and where it's been used by powerful private employers to counterattack against unions conducting kind of coordinated corporate campaigns, it is definitely a problem. But in this case, the union prevailed, the workers prevailed, and I think, you know, that's got to be the plan B, because if the law isn't changed, we're going to be back where we started, which is where we are now, and that means we've got to bypass the labor board. We've got to bypass these rigged elections where employers harass and intimidate, fire people, and sway the majority against unionizing. And I think we can do that if we organize like the UFCW did in Tar Heel.
Okay, well, Steve, thanks for calling in today. And I just want to state again your new book, Embedded with Organized Labor, Journalistic Reflections on a Class War at Home. And I wanted to quote one reviewer, Harry Kelber. Harry says, quote, "This is a book that every labor activist should read and think about." And coming from Harry, I think that's quite a recommendation.
He's a good friend and a terrific fighter at age 94. The book will be out in mid-May. You can order it now off the website of Monthly Review Press, which is a left-wing publishing house based in New York.
Well, great, Steve. Thanks so much for calling in today.
Great show. Thank you.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye.
Between prayer and revolution, between Jesus and Huey P. Newton, that's where you find Johnny Five shooting water guns at the audience while you're scooting. Your gluteus maxed due to the fact that he's tooting on the horn. Gonna warn you that I'm rooting for the other team in the culture war. So I stab the beast belly as the vulture snores. Yo, Joe, let it blow with convulsive force till walls fall off their false supports, till Jericho's aircraft carriers alter course, and all brave young Americans are called ashore. Cause we've already lost the war they keep waging, splattering the streets in battles that keep raging, bloody in each page in the story that we're studying. Each day the same, just the names keep changing,
saying the same things over again, repeating the same slogans, we don't know where we've been.
We've been all over the globe on our government funds, leaving man, woman, and child dead, bloody and numb.
Saying the same things over again, repeating the same slogans, we don't know where we've been.
We've been overthrowing leaders with legitimate views, democratically.
How many times can the line divide? How many wars to uphold your pride? These fears uncontrolled just swirl the tide of blood in the streets while the people die. I'ma keep on trying, long as suffering is multiplying. And why not? These souls getting tossed and left out. I rob my back broad enough to help lift your cross. As long as you help with mine, the process of healing will take some time. To see the pain in your face is the same as mine. It's not a game or a race, but the stakes is high. We may maintain our mistakes for the sake of size. As long as it takes, I'll say it one more time. As long as it takes, I'll say it one more time.
As long as it takes, I'll say it one more time. Saying the same things over again, repeating the same slogans, we don't know where we've been.
We've been all over the globe on our government funds, leaving man, woman, and child dead, bloody and numb.
Saying the
same things over again. Repeating the same slogans, we don't know where we've been.
We've been overthrowing leaders with legitimate views. Democrats.
Same thing.
U.S. is not
same
us.
Same thing.
And us is not we.
Same thing.
And we are not satisfied.
Same thing.
We're tired of the same thing.
Same thing.
And we're ready to make change.
Same thing.
Are we ready to make change? We want money for healthcare and public welfare.
Free Mumia
and Leonard Peltier. Human needs, not corporate greed. Drop the debt
and legalize weed.
We say yes to grassroots organization. No to neoliberal globalization.
Okay, we're back. That was the Flowbots we heard. And we just talked to labor activists and writer Steve Early. And it was a pretty good interview and stuff. And we'll probably keep in touch with Steve. I'm sure there'll be other things coming up here in the future that we might want to get his opinion analysis on. Anyway, there's an interesting little article I saw that was put online by this columnist, David Sirota, and it's talking a little about this financial crisis, and more importantly, about democracy in general here in this country. He starts out by saying, United Steelworkers President Leo Girard likes to say that Washington policymakers treat the people who take a shower after work much differently than they treat the people who shower before they go to work. In the 21st century Gilded Age, the blue-collar shower after work crowd is given the tough, while the white-collar shower before work gang gets the love. And never before this week was the doctrine made so clear. Following news that government-owned American International, and I want to repeat that, following the news that government-owned American International Group, AIG, devoted $165 million of its $170 billion taxpayer bailout to employee bonus. The White House insisted that nothing could be done to halt the robbery. Yeah. On ABC's new Sunday chat show, Obama advisor Larry Summers couched his passive-aggressive defense of AIG's thieves in the saccharine ergot of jurisprudence. He quote, we are a country of law. There are contracts, and the government cannot just abrogate contracts, he said. And I just want to point out, this is the same Larry Summers who said recently in the New York Times that unions are bad for the economy, and that's why he opposes the Employee Free Choice Act. But that statement, we are a country of law, which was echoed by John Adams two centuries ago, this fairy tale about an impartial government of laws and none of men. Only now the reassuring platitudes can't hide the uncomfortable truth. Last month, the same government that says it cannot just abrogate executive bonus contracts uses leverage to cancel union wage contracts. So Wall Street Journal reported federal loans to General Motors and Chrysler were made contingent on those manufacturers shredding their existing labor pacts and extracting financial concessions from the workers. In other words, our government asks us to believe that it possesses total authority to adjust contracts of car companies it lends to, and yet has zero power to modify contracts at financial firms it owns 80% of. Bob, what do you think of this? You've been following, of course, you follow financial news quite a bit and everything. I mean, in general, I mean, does this seem almost surreal at times?
There's a double standard out there, that's for sure, Dave. Some of the Southern senators have been trying to kill the automakers unions for months now, you know.
Well, that's a very good point. He mentions a little bit on this later in the article. He says, mind you, this double standard with the current Democrats in power works the other way, too. Congressional Republicans have long supported the laws letting bankruptcy courts annul mortgage contracts for vacation homes. Those statutes help the shower before work clique at least retain their beachside villas, no matter how many of their spectacular Ponzi schemes go bad. But for those who shower after work, it's Adamesque bromides against absolving borrowers of their personal responsibility. As the GOP announced, it will oppose any kind of legislation permitting bankruptcy judges to revise mortgage contracts for primary residents. In other words, they're going to basically try to get legislation to prohibit judges from trying to save people's, to redo their loans so they can stay in their homes. I mean, this is crazy. I never knew that that under bankruptcy laws that a vacation home could be left, that they couldn't touch it. I mean, that's just...
That does sound ridiculous, yes.
But anyway, then he ends the article. He says, certainly for all the connotations of fairness inherent in American politics, country of law catchphrases, lots of us are only now discovering that inequality is so pronounced that the time of day we bathe determines the enforcement and reliability or lack thereof, even the most basic contracts. And he says, we're just realizing that for all the parody of America's second president, we are ruled by a government of men, not by laws. So I thought that was an exceptionally good article by him. I read some of his articles, and I don't always agree with him, but for the most part, he's got some really good ones. One of my favorite ones, he's out at the, it was a Democratic convention in Denver last summer. Yes. One of his articles came out, was like about the third day he was there, which was entitled Dinner, it was Lunch in the Police State, Dinner with Ruling Class and Lunch in the Police State, which was basically he just came from the streets being, you know, having to dodge riot police and stuff that were just, you know, going on a rampage. And then he goes to a little restaurant, meets some friends, and then all of a sudden all these elites like Robert Rubin and Larry Summers and I mean all these old Clintonite you know, corporate people that have come in, and the ones who gave us NAFTA and everything, and having dinner and you know, and just having a grand old time and stuff. And it was quite an interesting article. I'm not really doing it justice, but anyway, we've got a few more minutes here before Bar Diverse, and I would like to mention, we were talking earlier about what's been going on in France, you know, it's interesting how in France you know, they get out in the streets, I mean, for the littlest thing, if you will, and you know, I'll tell you what, say what you will about the French, but boy, I'll tell you, they I mean, they definitely protect what they have. I mean, Sarkozy hasn't been able to get any of his anti-union legislation through, anti-education stuff, and it's all because of the people taking the streets. But I just wanted to throw something out about some interesting comparisons between the United States and other industrialized countries. You know, there's these things called American Human Development Index, HDI, which anyway, it measures, I guess, not just income, but also other factors of a society. And anyway, it's interesting because it says here that during the 1980s, the United States was consistently number two in the world, other than Switzerland, or actually number three other than Switzerland, Canada, as far as these indexes. But that about the mid 90s, we slipped to number six. And then by 2006, the most recent year available for the data, the United States has fallen to slot 15 of all the industrialized countries. And it's really amazing considering all the resources and development we have in this society. There's some things that the United States is still number one in. One is that we're the world's largest military exporter of weapons. Yes. Another number one is America imprisons more of its citizens than any other country in the world.
Yes.
That's 7.3 million Americans. One in every 31 adults are in the nation's prison system. It says we're number one in the world of spending the most on health care in this country. That's per capita health care spending. Number one in health care spending, but number 37 as far as quality and delivery of health care.
Yes.
I mean, that's pretty astounding. Also, we're number one in being overworked and vacation starved, number one in depression and mental health problems. I think the two kind of I think there might be a direct correlation there. But workers in Europe get anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks vacation. I know my wife's friends in Germany, all of them have 6 week vacations, and those are paid vacations, by the way.
A lot of state workers here in all the states are going to start having extra vacation. All the states are instituting these furloughs.
That's true
for all those state employees,
but they're not paid.
Right.
And that's the whole purpose of them, you know. So, and this is also this kind of shocked me. Nearly one third of the nation's population is illiterate or barely literate, and one in every 50 American children is homeless. And oh my God, look what just blew into the station here! I'm going to have to yield the mic here, and. Hold on, folks. We have a recent live development here in the studio.
You are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM.
Hi, this is Bill. This CD took much, much stress and very hard work to figure out how to make it on my computer with new things. So enjoy. This is broadcast. I believe it's Thursday night, the 6th anniversary of the Shock and Awe attack on Baghdad on the Mike Malloy show. He does this every year.
He's a So, quick question. How are you feeling right now?